Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, smoke from wildfires out west recently showed up on the East Coast, causing haze and raising air quality concerns.
When you're in high numbers like that, it's all about behavior change and making sure that you're making decisions that are protective of your health.
We hear from a state expert about the potential impact of wildfire smoke locally and how to protect yourself. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also bring you Arts Playlist, which heads to the Brandywine Museum of Art for a jazzy exhibition. Plus, we have the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Wildfires burning out west recently brought smoke and haze to the first state. It's the latest instance in what's becoming a growing regional trend, with prolonged poor air quality stemming from wildfires in the western part of the U.S. or wildfires in Canada. This week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon spoke with Angela Marconi, director of DENREC's Division of Air Quality, about how to make sense of the Air Quality Index and ways to protect yourself from lingering wildfire smoke.
Let's get some of the basics down when we're talking about air quality here. The Air Quality Index, or the AQI, only goes up to 500. Good AQ or AQI is under 50. Could you give us some insight into those numbers and how exactly air quality is measured?
Sure. So the AQI is EPA's way of trying to make some pretty complex science really easy to understand for everybody, either using the numbers or using the colors. Green is good. That is 0 to 50. Then we go yellow, orange, red, purple, maroon. When you're in high numbers like that, it's all about behavior change and making sure that you're making decisions that are protective of your health, and hopefully that you've already set yourself up for success if you have medication, that you already have it with you, and that you're making decisions like that. For the most part, we see readings that are either green or yellow. And in Delaware, we usually have a few days of the year for ozone where we go orange. And recently, we've seen some higher levels of particulate matter, but I wouldn't say that that's the new norm yet. We haven't quite gotten there.
And so is it all just smoke that's affecting, you know, our air quality here, whether it's now over the weekend, another time period, or, is there anything that's more specific to Delaware that might be impacting the data?
So, I mean, Delaware has long struggled with pollutant transport coming from upwind states into Delaware and bringing ozone precursors. And then we see the ozone formation happening in Delaware. So ozone is a secondary pollutant. It's not something that's emitted directly. Volatile organic compounds or nitrogen oxides are emitted directly from all sorts of sources, like mobile sources, cars, trucks, from factories or oil refineries or the facilities that make our electricity. And then the volatile organic compounds and the nitrogen oxides react with the sunlight to make ozone. So that happens, we get those compounds from other places coming into Delaware. And one of the things that happens is when you have transport of wildfire smoke, the wildfire smoke contains those compounds too. So it's not only bringing in particulate matter, but it's bringing in ozone precursors. And then when you have the sun come out and a hot, sunny summer day, you can end up with high particulate matter and high ozone. And we did see that somewhat last summer.
So those kind of things kind of compound in a way. But in terms of, you know, geography or wind patterns, how does that factor into AQ and how smoke or other pollutants kind of linger in a region like ours?
It factors in hugely, so much so that we work with a special forecasting company. In DENREC, we do not have meteorologists on staff to do that level of work because it is so complex. So we work with a company called Sonoma Technologies, and they give us an air quality forecast every day during ozone season. We post it on our website and it's available. It's at de.gov/AQI. And you can read, and it reads just like a regular weather forecast. Winds coming out of the south and, will cause dispersion or whatever. And they watch that really closely. So you can also sign up for our email listserv at that website, de.gov/AQI. And then you would get an email if we do forecast an air quality action day.
You mentioned before that this might not be necessarily a new term or a new norm, I should say, but looking at this long term, and how something like climate change isn't getting any better. The wildfires are only, seemingly getting worse, and the smoke that is, comes along with them is something that seems to be impacting and touching more areas around the country and the globe where otherwise or in previous years or historically it just hasn't. Does that change the messaging at all for as far as like when you're not a meteorologist, but in terms of like looking ahead and forecasting in terms of what AQ, what things will look like even 10 years from now? Does that factor into the messaging at all or the education and what to expect at least going forward?
Well, I think it's not just what to expect, but it's how to know where to get the information so that people can make decisions that are protective of their own health. So different people have different experiences, right? Like when last June, when we did have the high particulate matter, my eyes were absolutely on fire. I was attached to my eye drops. Some other people were less bothered by it. I know some people who were much more bothered by it. So it's to know what is good for you and then how to get the information. So I've said it a couple times already. I'm going to say it again, de.gov/AQI. We have our forecast there. You can sign up for the alerts there. The other tool that we really encourage people to use is airnow.gov. Which gives people access to a real-time data for particulate matter and ozone. And that's active throughout the year and it's throughout the country also. So if you're traveling, it also works. There's a phone app that works. And we just have this great resource now that even 10 years ago we didn't have. The real-time particulate matter monitoring is fairly new. So I think it's really exciting that people have access to this data and they can look at it. And actually, it's not only our monitoring stations. We have 11 monitoring stations in the state, and they are expensive to build and complex to operate. But there's air sensor technology that's also coming out. So I was at a library yesterday in Hokesen installing an air quality sensor. So now there is a particulate matter sensor at the Hokesen Library. So deploying sensors around also gives wider coverage and more information so that people have it during these events.
And when the air quality is very poor, it seems like at least when it is very poor, you can see it a bit. The sky is dull and the sun can look Mars-ish orange almost. You can smell it. It can be really nauseating. And is there any way you can tell when there is poor air quality outside of just looking outside or smelling the smoke? Would your best bet to, use something like a monitoring, technology or service, that kind of thing?
I mean, I would just encourage people to check airnow.gov. The sensors are fairly inexpensive. If someone is interested, it is something that people can install on their homes. There are indoor air quality sensors also. And then EPA has instructions. You can purchase, of course, like air filters for inside your house. Those can be quite expensive. EPA also has instructions for turning a box fan into a filter inside your house, which can be really
Wow.
helpful, especially if you're having a medical issue where you are extra sensitive to the pollution.
Right. Well, then what are some of those kind of ways to best protect yourself from poor air quality then? Like, there's air filters in the house, like the monitoring, the sensors, but outside of maybe just staying indoors and, closing the windows and running an air purifier and, all of the above. What can we do to best protect ourselves from poor air quality and maybe simultaneously improve our air quality?
Well, so we always encourage people to do things like to trip chain if you're going to go out. You know, instead of going back and forth to your house five times, you go out and do all your errands and then come back. Not top off your gas tank, not mowing the lawn at 7 o'clock at night because that puts the emissions out into the air late in the day. So different actions like that. When it's particulate matter, you can wear a mask outside. That can be very helpful. And the masks with the vents on them that weren't okay for COVID do work when you're talking about particulate matter in the air. So that's a little bit of a difference. I guess a couple other things. We always encourage people to have their medication with them. If you're asthmatic, you know, keep your inhaler with you and be prepared. And with ozone, we see ozone increasing throughout the day. So we're going to see the ozone peak every day, probably around late afternoon, like 4, 4:30, something like that. So we know that's going to happen. If it's a forecasted day for high ozone, you can get out earlier in the day to avoid that ozone peak. With the particulate matter, it's a little bit different because the air is coming in, you know, from wherever, and it's harder to predict when the peak is going to come. So it's just a matter of keeping an eye on the data and seeing what works best for you.
Thanks to Angela Marconi, Director of Denrec's Division of Air Quality, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We head to the Brandywine Museum of Art for Art's Playlist and a preview of a new exhibition showcasing the work of a longtime jazz photographer. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Longtime New York-based photographer Frank Stewart, best known for photographing prominent jazz musicians, has a new exhibition at the Brandywine Museum of Art in Chads Ford. Frank Stewart's Nexus, An American Photographer's Journey, 1960s to Present, features 100 black and white and color photographs that trace Stewart's travels across the globe and his approach to capturing black life and a range of diverse cultures. In this edition of Art's Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon explores Frank Stewart's Nexus with Brandywine Museum of Art Senior Curator Amanda Burden.
Before we get to the exhibit's finer points, a good place to start will be with Frank himself. So can you give us some insight into who he exactly is?
Frank Stewart is a fascinating guy. He's lived and traveled all over the world, but his roots are really in the American South. He had ties to Memphis and to Chicago and to New Orleans growing up. And I think he is always a great ambassador for American culture, American Southern culture, and American Black culture all over the world, wherever he goes. So when he begins photographing, it's actually at a very key moment. I always think this is so pivotal for him, taking his first professional photographs in 1963 when his mother took him to the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And that's the march where Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. So we have those very first photographs that Frank ever really took in the exhibition. And it kicked off a career's worth of inspiring work. You know, even though the show's not arranged chronologically, we have these subject matter groups. One of these groups is the rituals of life, of American life, of Black life, of Southern life. And so you see these repeated throughout the exhibition. It's really nice. Something Frank has observed throughout his life is things that people do on a daily basis, but then those special occasions too. For Frank, with his involvement with the world of jazz music, his family was involved with jazz music. It gave him an easy entree into the world of jazz as a young man. And really his first professional job was a road assistant to the jazz musician Ahmad Jamal. And so Frank gives us entree into his world. And that is the world of behind the scenes jazz musicians, the world of African-American visual artists, Frank is a barbecue pit master. And so one of his books, I mean, it's illustrations for a cookbook called Smokestack Lightning. And the range of worldwide images then comes from the fact that he was the photographer for Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra for 30 years. And so he was part of bringing jazz music to the world. He always talks about how when he's at home, he's comfortable and he photographs Black culture and he understands it and he lives it. But then when he goes abroad and he doesn't see something he's familiar with, then he's able to take a different position, trying abstract photography, exploring the cultures that he encounters while he's abroad, very artistic visions on top of it all. So it's certainly not just straight documentary photography. There is an element of documentary, but it's beautiful artistic photography as well.
Well, what are some of your favorites then? You know, can you describe some that really jump out at you personally?
Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the most stunning pieces in the exhibition is a really huge photograph. So some of these are reprinted at very large scale, so 5 feet across, and it's called The Bow. And it is a photograph that Frank took in Modena, Italy, when Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra was on tour. And he says they're in this beautiful old European opera house, and there's a lineup of American jazz musicians dressed in tuxedos, and they're taking their fifth or sixth bow at the end of the encores. And Frank took the opportunity to hop on stage with them and get behind them as they all took their bow in a single line. So as the musicians all bow, they reveal this beautiful ornate European opera house behind them. And it's such a beautiful composition, but then it really encompasses the mission of Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra to bring American jazz music to the rest of the world as well. So that is a really stunning work that we actually kind of feature toward the end as almost like Frank's kind of bow at the end of the exhibition as well. But I think for visitors to Brandywine, who have always been in tune to our environmental side of the house that deals with issues of land and water conservation, there's an interesting section in the exhibition. We talk about it as being social consciousness, but there is a focus on climate change and photographs of the outcomes of climate change issues. For instance, Frank visited New Orleans several years in a row during and after Hurricane Katrina to kind of photograph how New Orleans did and didn't recover in a way from that catastrophe. And so year after year, he'd go back and some of these photographs are included. And he points out not just the environmental catastrophe, but also the cultural catastrophe. One of the images is of an organ in a Black church in the Ninth Ward. And he came to learn how Black churches didn't recover in the Ninth Ward, that there was over 100 pre-Katrina and there's fewer than 20 now. The people weren't there and therefore the churches didn't recover. So he's documenting environmental issues, but also the social impact of those environmental issues.
You mentioned that these aren't in chronological order, and I'm just curious about that. You know, when you're, you know, how does installing an exhibit like this, like a photographic exhibit, vary compared to installing an exhibit based, you know, in paintings and drawings? Or as someone that's been doing this for a while, you know, is it all kind of the same to you at this point? You know, every exhibit's going to vary, but it is all kind of the same in that sense?
Well, I think this exhibition is a little bit exciting. Now, a lot of people might not be familiar with Frank Stewart's work. So maybe going through from his first exhibitions or his first photographs to the most recent would be helpful. We do have a great illustrated timeline for people to get the sense of how his career developed. But looking at these themes, for instance, the rituals that we mentioned, the sound, taste, and touch of cultures around the world, his social consciousness, the more abstract works called, he calls them drawings or windows. He takes shots out, views out of windows around the world. And his work in color photography. There are a lot of color photographs in this as well. Even though you might not then come away with the idea of first he did this kind of thing, then he did this kind of thing. You come away with an indication of what's important to this artist's career and life's work, and these themes that recur. One of the things we talk about in a tour, or if you listen to our audio guides, are the call and response aspect of Black life, whether it's in gospel music or something like that. And in a way, we see this visually. Frank sees a kind of image and it's attractive to him. So for instance, there's a recurring image, a recurring composition of a figure standing before a backlit, it's a window, maybe it's a spotlight on stage, right? And you see that call, and then you see the response or the echo throughout his career. Each time he sees that kind of composition before him, he captures it again. And it might be jazz musicians in New Orleans, and it might be when he went to explore his roots in Africa and the Caribbean. He catches a young girl, it was a chieftain's daughter, you know, standing in the light. But you see this response, this echo throughout his career, no matter what he's doing. You kind of get a sense of his personal aesthetic.
Such an eye. With Ruth, I know Ruth Fine and Fred Moten, we're also co-curators on this. What can you tell us then about them? And I'm also curious just how that works, essentially, you know, with yourself and then yeah. You know, those two.
So Ruth Fine is sort of a legend in the field of American art or art history. She was with the National Gallery of Art for more than 40 years as a curator. And in her retirement, she's still curating exhibitions and has been a longtime friend of Frank Stewart. So she knows him very well, has great insight into his work. And then Fred Moten is a professor at NYU who is also a poet, who's also a cultural critic, and is very taken by Frank's perspective on American Black life, but then also exploring Black cultures in other parts of the world as well. And so the two of them interviewed and wrote about Frank in the publication and made the selection of these works. And then when it came to Brandywine, one of the challenges is fitting 100 plus works into our space. So I think it's a really lively installation. There's always something to look at. There's rhythms that we create on the wall, which I think echoes the rhythms of, you know, the kind of the musical background. And there's actually a playlist to listen to as you walk through of jazz music that would be either by the artists you're seeing or referencing the photographs in some way.
I love it. Well, Frank Stewart's Nexus is indeed on view and open to the public right now at the Brandywine. What does the timeline look like for the exhibit, Amanda?
Yes, we are open now through September 22nd. So come celebrate Frank Stewart with us over the summer. And you can also listen to our audio guide, which is available offline as well. And the photographs are just stunning and so celebratory. It's a great summer field trip.
Thanks to Amanda Bird, Senior Curator at the Brandywine Museum of Art, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And the Green heads to the finish line next with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A More Just Delaware. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you another episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A More Just Delaware. The podcast examines pivotal moments in legislation related to hate, prejudice, and the fight for equal rights in Delaware. In this sixth and final episode, we focus on the 2016 legislation that formally recognized the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware. And Principal Chief of the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware, Dennis Coker, joins us on this episode to discuss the process of getting that legislation passed, why state recognition was necessary, and its impact. So I do want to start, Chief, with some historical context. You know, the treatment of indigenous populations like the Lenape is a dark and complex one and probably worth a whole separate conversation involving government policies of displacement and assimilation. Can you give us a brief explanation of what those policies and that history did to the Lenape Indian tribe?
Well, certainly, Tom. You know, the Lenape tribe was a vast group of people. Their traditional homeland was southeastern New York, the whole state of New Jersey, eastern Pennsylvania, over to about the Susquehanna, and then down the Delaware River drainage, including the state of Delaware. So they had a large area. So they had a somewhat large population. Most people figure that 25,000 may have been the pre-contact number for the people in that area. Of course, no one really knows specifically because there was so much early death attributed to a disease such as smallpox and measles and things like that. But the, you know, by 1750, most of the Lenape were already west of the Susquehanna. And so, you know, they had, because of the environmental degradation, they were cutting down all the trees, they were killing off all the animals, their relatives, which we call, which the non-native would call resources, were dwindling. So they were finding it difficult to even live. You know, they were building dams on the Brandywine, which shut off the shad migrations in the early spring and things like that. You know, so it was really devastating to the Lenape peoples.
How difficult was it to maintain the Lenape identity after that time of devastation and demoralization?
Yeah. Well, it was very difficult. For those of us that stayed behind, you know, it's my position that the only reason we were able to stay behind was because we Christianized very early. You know, by 1750, 1760, you know, my people that were living in the Cheswold community were Christian Indians. And as you read in the record, you'll hear reference to Christian Indians, and they say that a praying Indian is a safe Indian, you know, if he's saying Christian prayers. So in order to be Christian, we had to denounce all of our savage heathen ways, as we were described. So it really meant, you know, disavowing your culture. So it wasn't, you know, very popular thing to try to practice. And in many cases, it was illegal to even practice your native culture, you know, and it was illegal all the way up until, I believe, 1978 with the passage of the Religious Freedom Act, which allowed us to begin to do ceremony once again. So, you know, much of that cultural stuff was kind of underground, but it stayed live and well in many cases.
But certainly there was that prejudice and that danger of expressing your identity in any way that was even remotely public.
Well, you know, they were still fighting the Sioux on the plains, the Great Plains, in 1880. You know, we were reading the newspapers, you know, we saw what was going on out there, and you know, so it was very popular to deny being native, just for that reason. You know, we feared being put on a train and being shipped to Oklahoma, or worse yet, having to walk, you know, as the Trail of Tears right. evidenced in the 1830s with the Jacksonian removals. So, you know, it was not a very popular thing to do.
Before we start getting to the question of state recognition, were there some stepping stones toward beginning to express that identity and once again maybe mitigate some of those fears and such that you were talking about? That were those stepping stones toward moving toward state recognition?
Yeah, there were, you know, the early 1980s, the late 70s, the advent of the American Indian Movement, the AIM, as it's referred to. Actually, we began in 1991 with a 501c3, and you know, called it the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware. 1993, we had our first legislation debated on at Legislative Hall, a Senate Resolution Number 9, I think it was. And we were opposed by the Nanticokes, we were opposed by SHPO, Historic, Cultural Affairs. We were opposed by the Anthropology Department at the University of Delaware. And, so that really set the tone for our struggle here in Delaware. And then in 2000, we became aware of a program with the U.S. Census Bureau that was called a state-designated tribal area program. So you actually had to be nominated by HCA, and then that recommendation went to the Secretary of State, which HCA operates under, and then the Secretary of State would nominate you to the governor, who would nominate you to the Census Bureau. Well, they told us that we didn't have enough history in the state of Delaware to facilitate that nomination. So we were ignored in 2000. And then, which really left us, in idle mode for another decade because.
And I was going to say, before we start moving forward, I do want to go back a little bit to what you just said and start with those initial efforts in the 1990s. And you mentioned there was a fair amount of opposition. What was that opposition based on? Why were so many people kind of arrayed against that initial effort for state recognition?
Well, I think there was a couple of different reasons. At that time, the state was hanging its hat on the Nanticoke community being the only surviving Native community in the state. Of course, from the Native perspective, I'm sure they didn't want us to try to get our fingers in their pie. And the University of Delaware, they had aligned themselves pretty much with the Nanticokes. The Nanticokes were politically connected. They had a judge as a tribal citizen, it was just something that they, it seemed like they didn't want it for some reason or another. One tribe in the state was enough for them, and so they rallied their troops around they called us a triracial group, which really couldn't be further from the truth for most of the people in my community. Even for people like myself, every ancestor that I have on both sides of my family, my mother and my father, were born in the Cheswold community as far back as I can go in the historical record, which is like 1765. So anyway, that was the gist of their
And
opposition.
I imagine that that had to be frustrating because you would like to think that you would be making common cause with the Nanticoke, and instead it's they're as much of a barrier as anybody else, which seems that had to be terribly frustrating.
Well, Indians over through the course of history have not been good friends to each other. The divide and conquer mentality of the colonizing governments, pitting one group against the other for trade goods and things like that. I just look at it as a result of colonization. And that's why it's so important for us today to decolonize.
So you mentioned that you first sought that census tribal statistical area status for the 2000 census. It did not work out then, but it did for 2010 in Cheswold. Explain to us exactly why this was such kind of a watershed moment, getting this census status, and what came of that status once it was given to the tribe in 2010.
Well, it was very important for us to capitalize on that 2010 census opportunity. So we took the you know, the bull by the horns, and working with Dr. Kara Bloom, who was an anthropologist, I believe, with State Parks. She had been with us for quite a few years ever since our days with Ned Height, an archaeologist here in Delaware that was doing a lot of work with the Department of Transportation. So we developed our own evidentiary packet. We identified all of the references to the Cheswold community that existed by, you know, several anthropologists that had really come to Delaware to really talk with the Nanticokes. But when they were riding that train from Philadelphia to Millsboro, they passed through Cheswold and they recognized those people looked a lot like the ones we're interviewing down in Sussex County. So, you know, which really ended up with C.S. Westlager coming to Cheswold and really doing a somewhat of a deep dive in the 40s. So we put all that together in a packet and sent it to Governor Minner, in anticipation of this 2010 census. So when Governor Minner left office, I think it was in 2008, Jack Markell came into service as our governor. And one of his early actions was to take his department heads and say, is there anything left on your desk that we need to take care of from the past administration? Well, on the HCA desk, which had been that leadership there had been taken over by Tim Slavin, he read that evidentiary packet and his comment to me was, this is overwhelmingly convincing, so he felt comfortable enough to make the recommendation to the Secretary of State, who was convinced that, it was the right thing to do since we had been so sorely treated in 2000, to make the recommendation to the Census Bureau, and that happened. And we did receive the census designation for 2010. Along with that, which is kind of where the story gets a little murky, I received a letter from the Secretary of State in the summer of 2009 that actually said that the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware is a state-recognized tribe, okay? So everything was fine and dandy. We were satisfied. We finally got our state recognition. A couple of years went by, and we had in 2007, we had actually developed a confederation. It was called the Confederation of Lenape Nanticoke Tribes of the Delaware Bay. With the expectation that the three communities that exist in the Delaware Bay area, the Nanticoke, Lenape from New Jersey, the Lenape from Cheswold, the Nanticoke from Millsboro, would join in this confederation, and we would work on issues that were common to all three tribes. So we had that confederation put together, and in that confederation document, we had reciprocity clauses. You honor my citizens and I'll honor your citizens, things like that. Well, around 2012, the state of New Jersey decided to not recognize their state-recognized tribes. So the Nanticoke, Lenape, Lenape chief at the time, Chief Mark Gould, contacted me and asked me if I would go to bat for his artisans that were being harassed by the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, because to receive the benefits of the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, you have to be either a federally recognized tribal citizen or a state recognized tribal citizen. And now New Jersey was saying, we don't have any state recognized tribes. So, I took the opportunity. I wanted to test the waters to see what our recognition meant. So I said, sure, I'll do that, So I wrote a letter to the Indian Arts and Crafts board and advocating for these artisans that were being harassed in New Jersey. So the Indian Arts and Crafts board, in response to my letter, wrote a letter to the Delaware Attorney General saying who are these Lenape Indian tribe of Delaware people? So it turns out that back in 2009, when we received our letter from the Secretary of State, in the spring of 2010, the Indian Arts and Crafts Board, who periodically will poll the states and to see if they have any additional communities added or are there any that need to be taken off. Well, in the spring of 2010, the Attorney General answered that we have only one state-recognized tribe in the state of Delaware, and that's the Nanticoke. Right. So it was a classic example of the left hand of the state not knowing what the right hand's doing. So we did a deep dive into, you know, to that status. You know, the first thing I did was call SHPO and say, you know, do you consider us state recognized? And they said, we sure do, you know. And so when they looked into it, it turns out that the Indian Arts and Crafts Board only respects two different types of state recognition. One of those being recognition from a state Indian committee. So the fact that Delaware does not have an Indian commission, so it was obvious that our recognition didn't come from that avenue. So the other avenue is legislative action. So when we looked at our letter from the Secretary of State, it was not legislative action. It didn't qualify as legislative action. And even all of the references in Delaware's codes that talked about the Cheswell community, we had our own schools, the Department of Education had been funding our schools. None of that stuff added up to legislative action. So, you know, after almost a year and a half of trying to navigate, you know, with SHPO and the state, they suggested that I approach one of our local politicians to see if I can get a bill drafted for state recognition. So I actually wrote four letters, two to two representatives, two to two senators, because our area is kind of split a little bit. And I received response to one. And so, you know, that representative agreed to work with us on crafting legislation. So I ended up sitting down with the aides at Legislative Hall, and we drafted an awesome piece of legislation. And one of the you know, I was asked to comment on it and edit it. So, you know, with most legislation, it begins with a resolution with a bunch of whereas clauses.
Right.
You know, and which really kind of sets the groundwork for the be it resolved clause, which is only what ends up being the law,
right.
The be it resolved. So my request was, can we take all of this information in the whereas clause and put it down in the be it resolved, you know, area of the resolution, simply to prevent it seeming like we just fell out of the sky yesterday.
And I was going to say, what were some of those things, that those whereas things that you wanted in there that you felt would well, give the substantial foundation for it?
It talked about us having a 125-year relationship with the state of Delaware. It talked about the fact that we had you know, driver's licenses that identified us as a separate race of people. So, you know, things like that that really gave us a history. I wanted to see that down in the law.
I was going to say, ultimately, that legislation did wind up passing without opposition in both chambers. Yeah. And considering what we talked about earlier and that initial opposition in the 1990s, it had to be so satisfying to come to the end of this journey and have full support for what you were trying to do.
Yeah. The Senate and the House unanimously voted, passed that legislation on, you know, July 1st. Actually, the House was June 30th. I was sitting in there at 2:30 in the morning on July the 1st for the Senate portion of it, but both votes were unanimous. Governor Markell signed our legislation, I think, on August 4th. So we were off and officially codified as a state-recognized tribe.
So what doors did that open for the Lenape Tribe of Delaware?
Well, it's amazing because prior to that period, you know, it seemed that we lacked credibility. But after that legislation passed, it was like the floodgates were opening up. And, you know, people, collaborators, different academic institutions, different NGOs, environmental NGOs, you know, it seems like everybody wanted to have an Indian standing next to them on the stage at that point. You know, and, you know, I've been pretty vocal with my whole tenure as a leadership here. And much of what I had been doing in the, you know, the decade between 2000 and 2010 was to be where I was invited. I learned very early that if you're not at the table, you'll probably be on the menu. So the floodgates did open, and, you know, and they're still open to a great extent.
As we discuss these issues on this podcast, we've often sought to look at the personal impact, you know, noting that while we talk about some of these things conceptually, they also have very personal real life impact on people in their daily lives. And I'm curious how getting state recognition affected you personally and other members of the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware.
The one disappointment that I have had over the years is that many of our community members are still reluctant to raise their hand and say, I'm Native American. You know, we still only have about 200 enrolled citizens. So many of them have been reluctant and still are a little apprehensive. You know, the biggest response that we really did get were from, you know, educated tribal citizens who really understood the uniqueness of that status. You know, we still have a lot of work to do.
So that it sounds like that one challenge is kind of getting those people who identify as Lenape to actually kind of formally be Lenape. Beyond that, what are some of the other challenges? Does the issue of federal recognition come up? Does some issues of Lenape land, particularly in the Cheswold area, come up? What are some of the things that you, as you look forward, see as the things that you'd like to delve into or challenges you'd like to overcome?
Well, you know, it's a tumultuous period in Indian country right now. I know that every December I'm confronted with a discussion where there's a certain element of Congress is trying to defund Indian country. If it wasn't for the fact that many of the Western states have large populations of Native peoples, and those their representatives in Congress, you know, kind of have fended it off. But there still is an effort to defund Indian country. So the federal tribes are somewhat at war with us now. We've been gaining a lot of ground here in the East, and all of a sudden they're showing up where they never would before. You know, I never used to see many of the federal tribes at those consultations. And then probably about 5 or 6 years ago, they started to show up, and then they would refuse to continue with the consultation if a state recognized tribe was on the call. You know, we have some struggles there. For me, I don't really let that bother me too much. I am not a major fan of federal recognition, simply because, you know, the Creator granted us our sovereignty. I don't need someone else to reinforce it. We know who we are. And besides that, when, you know, the federal government, you know, they can grant you recognition today and take it away from you tomorrow if they feel like it. I mean, we can look at the termination period where they just terminated, you know, many tribes in the 50s, you know, so it's not a guarantee.
So bringing it back to Delaware, what is your level of optimism for the next generation of Lenape here in Delaware in terms of the visibility, in terms of the population? What do you see as that as the future of the Lenape Indian tribe of Delaware?
In a ways, it's a little bit bleak. You know, the community I grew up in was a community that was endogamous, meaning we were marrying within. So when they closed down our schools in 1964, you know, we started to, you know, when Cupid, you know, starts firing his little arrows, there's not a whole lot you can do about it. So we started to intermarry to a great degree. And that intermarrying is more prevalent nowadays than marrying within. So, you know, with us having a 25% blood quantum requirement, it's getting more and more difficult for us to find qualified citizens. You know, we're doing as much as we possibly can, you know, and trying to keep our center door open.
You've been listening to the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware, with Dennis Coker, Principal Chief of the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware, discussing Delaware formally recognizing the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware in 2016. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. The podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Delaware Humanities is a recipient of United We Stand, Connecting Through Culture funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities to support A More Just Delaware and related programming. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Humanities Rachel Sheffield and Delaware Public Media's senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.